Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast. Special, festive, four-part Gamers Confab Favorites of 09 Holiday Edition. Hi, everybody. Happy holidays and welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I am happy to have you with me as always. This is my annual end of the year podcast where I round up the Gamers Confab, new members and old, to discuss our favorite games of 2009. As you may know, I encourage my guests to choose the game that best struck their fancies this year, which may be different than the game that one might call best game or game of the year or whatever. These are our personal choices of games that meant something to us this year. As always, I'm grateful to all of my guests for these Gamers Confab segments, both new and old. I try to always add a few new voices to the mix, and I've done that again this time. And you'll also hear from some familiar voices, too. I've discovered, as I've gone along, that the Confabbers are growing in number, so I can't round up everyone in the mix or, you know, I'd be doing like 10-part podcasts and collapsing in a heap at the end. But I greatly appreciate all the bloggers and journalists and designers that have joined me in the past, and I hope we can get together again soon on future podcasts. These are great fun for me to do, and I hope you enjoy them. So I'll blast things off with part one of our Favorites of 09 podcast by welcoming my first three guests. Steve Gaynor is a designer at 2K Marin, where he and the rest of the team have put the final touches on Bioshock 2. Steve also writes one of the best gaming blogs on the net called Fulbright, and he's recently written there about the game that he chose as his favorite this year. I won't give it away. I'll let Steve tell you all about it in the segment. I'm also joined by Kirk Battle, a.k.a. LB Jeffries, who writes the Banana Pepper Martinis blog and reviews games for Pop Matters. Kirk also recently wrote a retrospective piece for Edge magazine on Rockstar's game The Warriors. And to round out the group, I'm also joined by Chris Dallin, who writes for the Onion AV Club and contributes a regular column for Edge Online. So, I hope you enjoy the first of four segments. Look for the remaining ones to appear over the next week. Once again, thanks to all my guests, thanks for listening, and away we go. I want to welcome three gentlemen back to the podcast, Steve Gaynor, Chris Dallin, Kirk Battle, veteran Gamers Confabbers, and this is our year-end Best Of edition, although our version of Best Of really isn't Best Of necessarily as some sites think of it, more our favorite game of 2009, and we really don't have a specific definition of what that means. Favorite to you is favorite to you for whatever reason. And I expect some of those reasons might be, you know, sort of personal to you. So that's the question. That's the subject we're going to explore. And why don't we lead off with Chris Dallin? And let's hear about your favorite game of 2009.
Well, I think my favorite game, and I know that you like this one too, Michael, is definitely Demon's Souls.
Yes.
And, and I just did a top 10 list and, you know, the point distribution, and I just slammed all the points I could onto Demon's Souls because it was just the most riveting, pure gaming experience I had all year. I still haven't finished it. I'm about, you know, a third of the way through now. I banged through three different bosses this weekend and just felt such a sense of achievement for that. So I just love that game. And at the same time, it's you know, as we've discussed, it's sort of a hard game to talk about because, or to have an interesting, intelligent conversation about, because there really isn't much. It's all you really want to talk about is the experience and the stats and sort of what weapons you picked up and what choices you made. And to anyone outside, it would be just be incredibly dull. It would be like those people at baseball games who keep their own scorecards. You wouldn't, I mean, you know, you're not going to like hold up your scorecard and say, look what I did. It's like, no one cares. No one cares except the people who are immersed in this. So that would definitely be my pick. And I'll just say too, I'm pleased that it seems to have gotten a pretty good reception. I know Atlas tried pretty hard to get it out there, and it made some top 10 lists. I know at least one person who was working on a top 10 list who said everyone was kind of nervous about putting something that unconventional on there, but it does seem to be getting some accolades.
I'm a big fan of the environments in that game, of what you would, I guess it would call it level design, but it's more than just level design. The atmospherics, the whole sense of place is really powerful in that game. So, I mean, so much so that it's a bit like a horror game in a sense for me. I don't think it's designed, obviously, as a horror game, but there are moments when, you know, you really get the chills headed down this, you know, dark staircase, or, you know, headed into a dark area where you're not sure who's going to pop out. And it feels like there's so much at stake at those moments, because you may be pretty far away from an escape place, and you've built up a lot of points, and yeah, you know, you stand to lose everything at that moment if you make a mistake. There's just, it feels like so much is on the line at times.
What kind of place does it take place in? Like, what is the place that's being conveyed?
It's a fantasy world, and it's pretty much to type. You've got dragons, you've got monsters that are familiar, and sort of also kind of some kind of dreadful creatures that just look miserable or look spooky or are ghostly. But, you know, all the types are familiar. It's not breaking new ground, and I mean, a lot of it just feels very neutral. In terms of, like, the name is Boletaria or something, which doesn't, you know, it's sort of, all that stuff is forgettable. But it's, yeah, like Michael says, the atmospherics, I mean, the sound design is unbelievable. Like the reverb on all the voices, and there are good voice actors as well. And the lack of, for most of the game, there's no music. So there's nothing to kind of set a mood or help you anticipate what's coming or help you feel reassured in any way. It's, there's just no music, except during the boss battles, and most of that music is sort of ridiculous and almost this kind of mocking sound while you're trying to survive. And so it's very much, you're supposed to be very in the moment. You're not really supposed to be thinking about, oh, I'm saving this kingdom or preserving it from whatever, it's rescuing it from whatever horrible fate has descended on it. You really are just like, oh my God, what's around this corner, and am I gonna survive?
Yeah.
And yeah, Michael, I agree with you. I mean, there were some, I just did a part where you're kind of descending into this long hole in a mine, giant hole, and there are platforms that you could just barely see, or sometimes you can't see them at all, and you just have to jump and hope something's under there, and you have no sense of where you are, how far it's going, or what's going to be at the bottom. And yeah, it's utterly terrifying. Even when you kind of are comfortable enough to realize, you know, I screw up, I just go back 5 minutes, you just don't think, you're trained not to think that way.
Yeah,
you're trained
exactly
to think it always matters.
Exactly. And it, for me, you get a certain momentum going, and then you'll think, well, I'm just going to go, like, I'm just going to see where this goes. And so you get on this, like, little elevator type thing, and you descend down into this sort of, like, underground swamp. I don't know how else to describe this place. Have you been there yet, Chris?
I haven't done that one yet.
Okay.
No.
Oh my God. So there you are, and you know, you've just done some, like, really heroic stuff, and you feel like, you know, Mr. Badass, and you feel like you've got enough spices to keep your, you know, mana going and all that sort of typical RPG stuff. And you're down there, and you realize, oh my God, this was a huge mistake. Like, I can't, this is too much for me. And they start coming at you from under the water, and they kind of rear up and grab you, or they break your shield or whatever. And then you've got to figure out a way to get out of there without dying, and still sort of navigating your way through an environment that you really don't know. So you're exploring, fleeing, using strategy, trying to figure out what weapon to use. It's just the amount of sort of intellectual stimulation mixed with fear in this game. Just, I don't, God, it just totally turned me on. Totally got me.
It sounds really, I mean, it sounds really great. I love the intensity and the amount of investment in it. I still need to get a PS3.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's always funny when you play a JRPG that's actually hard, because I remember, like, with Persona 4, I mean, it's not going to mention plot, because it's just kind of like, well, those monsters aren't killing themselves.
Yeah.
You need to get cracking.
Yeah.
It just, like, the story is, like, you trying to deal with these insane giant things.
Yeah, and the difference, I think, in why it in some ways doesn't feel like a typical JRPG is that you get the feeling with bosses in those kind of games that they're designed to just be this big, huge, like, behemoths that just require a bunch of whacks, you know, like how many whacks will it take to get him down? And you whack him one way or whack him another way. But this game, I mean, it has boss battles that are a bit like that, but that really isn't what the feature attraction of the game is. It's more...
Yeah, it's 1% of the time you're in there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, beating them feels good, but it's really just staying alive. And the difference between being fully alive and being sort of a soul in the game where you really don't have all your health and you're really sort of not quite alive, you're kind of just wandering around in this kind of netherworld. When you do get your life back by beating a boss and you're sort of fully back to being human, you really want to protect that. You know, because you have more life, you have more power. And so
yeah,
that's
feels
always
so
a
precious.
Stink.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very. Yeah. Oh, God.
But you know, another thing I really admire about it is that the levels are very small, relatively. I mean, when you think of something as sprawling as Fallout 3, where you could go through one of those vaults and really only pass through a hallway once or twice in your life, and you're just sort of meant to keep going and keep going and keep seeing new things. And the fact that the levels in Demon's Souls are fairly small, and both because of the difficulty and then because it can take a little while to unlock certain things, you spend quite a bit of time in each piece of it and become really, really familiar with it. So it makes it feel really useful. It makes it feel like your time is valuable. It makes it feel like every part of the level is valuable. Every nook and cranny was really thought through, and you're really meant to absorb it and experience it. They just don't waste anything in it. I mean, this is a game you can spend dozens of hours in, but nothing feels wasted. You don't open crates. You don't have to like sift around and maybe find some garbage that you may or may not need. Like anything you find is probably going to be pretty useful. The other thing is like it's very hard to go from that game to any other RPG. So, you know, I tried Torchlight, couldn't stand it. It just seemed so silly compared to Demon's Souls, and I tried Dragon Age, which I was really interested in because I like BioWare games. I like the story. I like the branching storyline. I like having all these discussions with people online about, oh, who did you choose? Who was your romance option? How did you do with this plot twist? And I thought that the branching narratives in that game were terrific and brutal in their own way, too. But it just, the minute-by-minute experience of it was so turgid compared to Demon's Souls. It was a little hard to get through at times.
Yeah.
Well, I really liked what you were saying. I mean, it sounds good what you were saying about the way that, yeah, none of any level is disposable, basically, because it's something that I've been thinking about a lot. Just, you know, in games that sort of contrast like a, you know, linear movie-like ride forward versus games that are more about exploration and everything. I mean, for instance, I played through part of the Modern Warfare 2 single-player campaign, and it's in, I don't know, the third level or something. It's, I don't know if you guys remember it, but you're in a car, and like the guy that was driving the car gets shot, and you jump out, and you have to like chase a dude, you know, and you're running through a city, and the city has all these civilians in it, and there's all these things going on and everything, but you're chasing a guy. And so I was looking around, and I was like, man, they really built like multiple city blocks here. And I looked off to the side, and I looked into like a house, and I went inside, and it was like this posh apartment that, you know, had like modern furniture in it and stuff. And I just kind of looked around, and then the screen faded to black, and it was like, you lost the guy, mission failed. and I was like, they had so much money, and the experience was so disposable that they probably had someone spend, you know, days or weeks of their life building and decorating an entire apartment that you literally lose the game if you spend any time looking at it, you know? And just that whole philosophy of game making is, I don't know, it just feels like conspicuous consumption to me. It's just so wasteful. Like, and so, you know, working on a BioShock level or whatever that's more about open exploration, and it's like, you know, this place is a place, and actually, you know, use all of it. Don't just like run through it with your blinders on, you know, looking all the corners and everything. There's a whole spectrum of that, but I'm really attracted to a game like the one where you're describing, where it's like this place actually has to be important to you, and you have to think about it and exist in it, and not just kind of sprint through it and throw it in the garbage as soon as you know, walk around the corner. That's really cool.
That's funny. I remember, with Modern Warfare 2, it's funny you should mention that. I horrified one of my friends because I spent most of No Russian just looking at all the details. So, I mean, it's kind of this weird thing because I was already numb to it. Like, I knew what was going to happen, but it's amazing how much time and energy went into that game, and the whole game is running around being shot at. And you're just kind of like, they have individual like books, and like the burgers are individually wrapped in the game. And so many levels are just amazingly. I'm trying to think, like the one where the plane crashes into the mansion. If you go into the kitchen, there'll be a Russian soldier like digging in the fridge, and it's animated. Like you can watch him for like 5 minutes. There are people playing basketball on the base. I spent, like, most of Modern Warfare 2, I didn't really like it because the plot doesn't make much sense. But once you started, I started just looking for, like, Easter eggs, basically. It was kind of a little bit more enjoyable.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff is, like, important kind of in any kind of game. I mean, people unconsciously, I think, absorb that kind of attention to detail. But, you know, there's certain experiences that either encourage you to actually pay attention to it and interface with it, and some that just outright discourage you, you know, from actually investing yourself in any of this stuff they spent so much time and attention on, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you can't go in and you can't look at it. I mean, at least like a DVD, I just remember Fight Club, there was a special presentation, you know, I was watching the bonus features, and they were explaining some of these sequences that go by in 3 seconds, some of the dreams or whatever sequences. They'll have like a little bottle flying through the airplane when they lose pressure, and someone sat there doing the label on the bottle and everything like that. But at least maybe you could hit pause, you know, look at it or something.
Right.
Well, Chris, just one more thing about this game. It struck me that maybe Steve would have a way of thinking about this from a design perspective. Part of what Demon's Souls does to you is it prevents you from accessing certain areas. And so you're walking by this gate and you can look in there and you can't get in. And it's not clear to you what it would take to get in there, but you know that there's something in there. And it may be unlocking a whole area that you're going to explore later. It may just be sort of teasing you. But I found that sort of returning to the game when the world tendency is a certain way, and this is another whole thing we haven't discussed, which is the world changes, it becomes from sort of dark to light, so the nature of the world changes, the nature of the enemies you confront changes, and actually your access to certain areas of the game changes depending on whether it's white or black or anything in between. So you find yourself sort of going back in to see whether you can get into those places now, or is there something I haven't done yet that would get me in there, and it just in terms of like sticking you to the game, I found it pretty compelling.
Yeah, that is I'll admit I used a wiki for a lot of the game, and I try not to spoil new levels, but when I've been through a level, I'll go and look up what I might have missed, and those are some of the kind of events. I mean, it's sort of like you might look at my block, you don't know when the trash pickup is necessarily, you know. It's like then you show up on a Thursday morning, you're like, "Oh, look, there's a truck coming down the street." I mean, it's weird. I mean, yeah, I guess there's that level of obsession that there are people, I mean, they're contributing to the wiki, who spend that much time in the game and get to know it. And then, I guess that's the modern way of playing, is that people like me can kind of benefit from having that information. I don't have to like go through that level of collection. I'm sure the designers were thinking of that. Like, they're like, this really important encounter only happens if you happen to be in here during the white world tendency. And you wouldn't even know that. And you probably wouldn't even know what a white world tendency is just from, if you just lived on a desert island playing this game, you'd really have to spend some time figuring it out. I picked up a sword the other day that was like draining my health, and I just, it didn't explain anywhere what was doing that, or that it wasn't a bug, or that it wasn't that I wasn't poisoned. And then it was weird too, because I also had a regeneration ring. So I thought that the regeneration ring was just sort of bouncing up and down and up and down, and just, you know, nothing tells you that, but you know, I mean, that's, yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I'd love to know what they thought of, why they thought of doing that. I guess they just figured either they figure out or you just go online.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's that like, system where you can leave notes for other players, right?
Right.
Does that apply to this kind of stuff?
It's very simple. My opinion is it's more like they'll leave very short messages, and they'll be like, jump down here, or look around that corner, or go to the right. I mean, it could be as short as right. They're definitely not long paragraphs, and they definitely aren't really long wiki style, hey, do this or that on the other thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're lies. Sometimes they lie to you, like they tell you jump here and you do and you die.
that's so evil. I mean, I love it. That's great. So a note, there was something like, you know, for instance, come back here during the white phase or something. There wouldn't be anything like that. I don't know what system they use for leaving that stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. There's an area in the third world where there's this area that's blocked, and someone will leave a note saying you need pure white soul to get past here.
I see.
And so you'll know that. But yeah, like Chris says, they're very simple notes and they're all pre-written.
Yeah, like the thing that you're mentioning on a higher level, what it reminds me of is something that I read about the original Legend of Zelda, was that Miyamoto put in a lot of stuff in that game that is relatively undiscoverable by a single player, specifically because he wanted people to have to essentially play it together, like talk to your friend who, you know, you go to school with, and right. ask him, oh, how do I, you know, get to the seventh dungeon? And he or his friend or something, like, or he, you know, from three or four layers deep, somebody found that one hidden wall in the mountains that's completely, you know, not marked in any way. You just have to press against it and walk through a what looks like solid rock. And he wanted to encourage people to have to essentially pool their knowledge and not to be able to play it all on your own. I think that's really interesting, especially for such an early game, and one where there was no internet or anything. You know?
right. Really just schoolyards. But I mean, at the same time, a lot of these things also aren't there. They don't block you from finishing the game. So for example, like Final Fantasy VII, I was able to finish that. I didn't go through some of the end dungeons. I didn't get the Knights of the Round. I didn't get, I didn't read Chocobos. I didn't do any of that stuff. I didn't really have any trouble finishing it anyway. And it was just looking back that there's this whole extra level of world that you can, you know, you can do. And I think that's kind of nice. You know, if 50% of the game is the stuff you have to do and the other half is just, you just love it so much. And also they don't want you to return the game. So you leave it on your shelf forever because it's like, well, someday I'm going to like break both my legs and I'm going to have to sit here and do this. So
we're going to move on. But Chris, just one last quick question about Demon's Souls. I think that the perception of the game, sort of the word about Demon's Souls, is that it's hard. That's sort of the one thing people know about it. It's really hard. What factor is that in your sort of connection with the game? Did the hardness of it, the difficulty, play a role in sort of keeping you at a distance or drawing you in? Or how did that work for you?
I think it made me curious to want to check it out. You know, it's alluring to say that, to say, oh, this thing is so hard. You know, I don't know if you really should give this a try. You might not be up for it. it can be tempting to a lot of people. And I think the other factor, though, is that where it's hard is the first few hours. When you can't level up, when you really can't gain strength in any way, you can upgrade your weapon. I finally figured that out. But the very first part of the game, you're kind of stuck where you are and you just sort of have to get smarter and faster because it's definitely an action RPG and a little more capable before you could finally figure out a way to start leveling up. At that point, you can start grinding. And I'll admit, I mean, I've been grinding a lot to get to a point where things are starting to get easier and sort of more comfortable because I'm just not the fastest in player. What I like about it is it makes you feel very helpless at first. You know, within 5 minutes, this thing kills you in one blow and you're kind of stuck like that for a while, feeling very vulnerable and feeling like, oh, you know, maybe I should reroll my character. Maybe I just am doing this wrong. Once you start to get past that, you feel more and more in control of what you're doing. You feel more like you understand kind of every nuance of what you're dealing with and how to be. And that's what's so rewarding about it. And then even when you kind of go through a part and keep getting spanked and keep getting spanked, you feel like you really understand it, and then you can keep persevering. So anyone who hits, I think, the 10-hour mark can sort of start to deal with it and start to see what they're up against. And at that point, it doesn't become so hard. I mean, it's not like Ninja Gaiden, where I would never be able to finish that game. I mean, I just don't have the fingers for it. Demon's Soul, I think you can get so absorbed in it that you understand, and I think it absorbs you enough that you want to get to that point.
Well, we should mention that you know, one reason that it's tough beyond the stuff you're talking about is that a real life player can drop into your world and come hunting for you.
Yeah, there's a lot of griefing, there's a lot of hassle. But.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I love that game too, and you know, I think it probably is my game of the year too, but I can't commit to that because, you know, I got to save my choice at the end. So
And by the way, you've mentioned, I don't even know if you've published, Michael, that you finished it.
Oh,
which
yeah.
I just like so much. And I don't know why you aren't just bragging and just freak out.
I will say it does tap into that thing about being a gamer that goes way back to when I was, you know, like much more raw, sort of had more time on my hands. That notion that I beat this, I did this in this much time, I got this many coins, I got this many whatever, that I have to admit, beating Demon's Souls felt really good to me. Sort of like, I can still do it. I still got it.
That's awesome.
So should we toss it to you, Steve? And let's hear about your favorite game of 2009.
Oh, sure. Yeah. This is a weird, kind of weird year because, I mean, there weren't giant monoliths of like, holy crap, this was definitely the best thing, which is kind of nice because I ended up picking something smaller, which is Syrah by Niflis. You self-released it on the PC. It's an indie side-scrolling kind of Metroid style exploration game. There's no combat in it. And have you guys played it? I know you played it at least some, Michael.
Yes, I finished it actually. I was a huge fan of Knit Stories, so when I saw he had that game out, I pretty much jumped on it. In fact, I stopped playing Demon's Souls to play that game.
Whoa. Well, luckily it didn't take
up a demo.
Yeah, I mean, one nice thing is that you know, it didn't take you that. You didn't have to step away from Demon's Souls for that long to play all the way through the game. No. Because it's, I don't know, I didn't track exactly how long it is, but it seemed like it was five or six hours. It depends on, I guess, how quickly you jam through it. But I was attracted to it because I was a fan of Knit, and it is very Knit-like. Basically, the premise is that you play as a female character named Syrah in this kind of, I guess, futuristic Earth, you know, fictional world. Your sister's sick, and you try to take a teleporter to Mars to find her. And when you do, you arrive, and there aren't any people anywhere else. And so the basic plot is you need to go all over the galaxy using your spaceship to find different parts for the teleporter to teleport to a place where you think you can find the answers to what's going on. And yeah, it just takes the form of this wonderful, ambient, you know, just sort of like good-natured adventure across all these different planets that are based entirely on exploration and using your spatial reasoning to figure out how to get to all the different parts of any given planet by, you know, running and jumping and wall jumping and climbing up things and basically saying, what are my verbs and how can I traverse this space in pursuit of finding the clues that you'll need and the means to solve puzzles that are like logic puzzles that take all sorts of different forms. There's an impressive variety of different, like, clever kinds of puzzles that you need to wrap your head around to generally, like, restore power to something or remove a laser barrier so you can get to this teleporter, to a different teleporter piece. And so that's all really nice and good, and that's more or less what Knit was. Knit didn't even have the puzzles, so, I mean, the puzzles are an additional layer to the Knit formula. But I was just really impressed with the additional breadth of the experience that Cyber brought to it. I mean, it added, you know, a human character and much more kind of evocative high-res graphics that made you feel more like you were in a world. It still has that great feel of Niflis's, you know, 8-bit, very kind of esoteric alien worlds that feel very unique. But then it adds all of these other elements that make it feel like such a full galaxy, you know, between flying between different planets that each have their own identity and having to find fuel for your ship to fly to different locations. And there's a PDA that has, you know, a hint system and a camera in it. And you know, kind of like Jade from Beyond Good and Evil, you use the camera to help you make progress towards solving the puzzles. And it just has that great feeling of completion and achievement and gradually unlocking this whole universe, untying a huge knot and being done with it, and, you know, having felt like I started as this one tiny speck on, you know, a grassy plain next to a spaceship, and I've spidered out and filled every nook and cranny of all these different planets, and I've gotten to know them, and and I've really expanded myself and my experience of this place by playing it. And then it has a number of satisfying conclusions based on which teleporter pieces you find. There's multiple endings, and if you find them all, you can easily, you know, experience all the different endings. It doesn't sort of punish you and say replay the full game to see another ending. You can see all the different possibilities, you know, that are like, well, what if I had used this piece and this piece, what would have happened? And being able to feel out all the possibilities of the conclusions in a legitimate way is really, really nice. And, you know, it made me think constantly. Like, that's what I loved about it. You know, it wasn't mindless. It wasn't twitchy. Again, there is no combat. The entire sense of fun and enjoyment that you get out of it is from figuring out the world. And I remember I was playing it and I was maybe halfway through it, and I almost felt like mentally exhausted, you know, like I could feel the sensation of like, man, I've just been thinking hard constantly, like for the hours that I've been playing this game, you know, like connecting the dots between this part of the world and this part of the world, and where was this clue and what did it mean? And once I've unlocked this puzzle, what's that going to lead me to, you know? And you can't just kind of passively wander around and let it wash over you. It requires mental investment moment to moment. And games have so much like inherent potential to require that of the player that so much passive media, I mean, really almost no passive media requires. I mean, even reading, you have to be invested in reading the words to progress through it. But games can cause you to, you know, make those neural connections nonstop in a way that feels incredibly satisfying. And so that was my favorite gaming experience of 2009.
Nice. You guys interested in this game now?
Yes.
The demo was great. It's like one of the, it's on the list. I love the way he always breaks it down into it's like doing a crossword puzzle to me, because it's sort of each world, you know, it's like self-contained into like tiny segments, and so each one is like 30 minutes to an hour, so I'll just like plow through one, and then, you know, you can like set it back down. There's not this kind of straight line mentality to it.
Yeah.
Do you have any curiosity about the level editor and sort of getting your hands on it from that side of things?
Well, I read about that on Niflis's forums, and he basically said, technically, you can edit levels, but I wouldn't suggest anyone actually try to do it, because it's going to be nearly impossible for anyone except me.
Okay.
Because I programmed it, and importing new assets and making new puzzles and stuff is basically requires editing the source code. And so, yeah, not really end user friendly. It could be really cool if it were more feasible. Yeah.
Yeah. What is it about his work? I mean, would you say that he has a certain kind of signature? I mean, I think you've talked about some things, but he really seems to me to be a designer. You know, he leaves his fingerprints on his games in a kind of wonderful way. So from your perspective, how does that work?
Yeah, it's definitely true. I guess he makes worlds that feel genuinely alien, and they convey a sense of wonder about like what other places could be like, you know, in a way that's palpable. And I think it just takes a certain sensibility that only some, you know, artists and creators have to, I don't know, kind of think of places like, put your mindset far enough outside of your known context and think of just what could other worlds be like. And then what he brings to it is not, you know, is so far removed from the, you know, kind of gritty, bloody, you know, version of other worlds that we see in video games a lot of times. and instead, yeah, it's just like he creates places that you can be amazed by, which is just wonderful to experience.
Yeah, that totally captures it, the experience for me. You just like being there, like just being there. All by itself.
And kind of like, I mean, what Kirk said, you know, each of these planets is its own little self-contained Metroid world, you know, that you can take, like you said, like half an hour or an hour to get through. And part of the joy of it is just the satisfaction at completing this one self-contained set of challenges and really feeling like you've, you know, accomplished something within that time frame. But that also, it means that every half hour or hour, you're being introduced to a totally new kind of place, which is really attractive. You know, yeah. You're like, oh man, I got to know this place in this short amount of time, and it was great. And now I'm going to get to see something totally new.
Yeah. Well, we should mention that Steve has actually written about this game on his blog. I'll link to that on my site when I release the podcast. But you should definitely read Steve's piece, because he sort of elaborates on some of these things there, I think, in a really cool way.
Yeah. I mean, something worth noting, I think, almost related to like the Miyamoto thing, is that Niflis is also trying to encourage people to play this together, in that if you go to his site, you can download the demo, and then you can buy a copy for $17, or you can buy two copies for $19. So it's basically like, it's almost free to play this with a friend instead of playing it on your own. It's cool. A really interesting approach, and I wonder how it'll work out for him. But yeah, people should check it out.
One last little thing about that. I don't know if you would see this the same way, Steve, but I don't know anything about Niflis other than just playing his games. And he's got a really simple website that, you know, there's sort of no muss, no fuss. Just here are the games. And yeah. I think, I don't know, this is like his third game or fourth game. But part of the interest for me with Syro was you can sort of watch him develop as a designer. I mean, he's really growing. And, you know, what he does, he sort of iterates on Knit with Knit stories, which is kind of cool, in that you can sort of see him kind of add value to that game. But really, the leap between the Knit games and Syra adding, as you described it, sort of beyond platforming these puzzle elements, but also kind of enriching the world. I don't know. It's just fun to watch this guy grow.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like Knit, I thought was a really lovely aesthetic experience. And I mean, it was fun and you know, navigating the world worked well and everything. But Syra gave me a totally different appreciation for Niflis as just a pure game designer, because like there's just really good solid level design, you know, level layout stuff, like navigation, you know, the nuts and bolts of spatial design above and beyond how it looks and, you know, how it sounds and what little creatures and stuff, and all of the different puzzles that he uses are so varied and work so well, you know, that yeah, I really felt like, man, this guy, core game design between systems and level design, as well as having this wonderful aesthetic outlook on the world, it's like I was really impressed on all fronts. Yeah,
well, that is Syra, and it's from Niflis Games, and I'll put a link on the website so you can all check it out. I hope you will check it out, and thank you for that, Steve.
Yeah,
so we're gonna move to Kirk, Mr. Kirk Battle, and
yeah.
This is, by the way, just on the side, this is, you know, you've had a huge year writing, sir. You've been a really busy writer this year. I mean, I suppose you were last year when we talked, but I think you sort of stepped it up this year, despite all of your law school obligations and other things you're doing. But you've written some incredible stuff this year.
Yeah, it's been a great year. I've been, like, thinking a lot about what, like, sort of was driving me. And I was dropping off my bar application today, actually, and I was thinking about it. I was like, you know, I think the reason I stick with the video game thing so much is because it's kind of this one thing that I can control, you know? Like, so much of my life right now is just kind of up in the air. I couldn't tell you what I'm going to be doing this time next year. I don't know what's going to happen to me, but it's kind of like, with this thing, if I just work hard at it, I can produce good stuff, and I can feel good about it, and it doesn't have to be, you know, any of the other things going on for me right now. I just, because I was, you know, one of my friends was like commenting that I was kind of crossing into Captain Ahab area with like the amount of writing. And I was like, yeah, I think I was sort of just like clinging on to it these days, you know, and I hope I can keep it up during the summer and everything during the bar. I've told Pop Matters I'm going to give them another 6 columns and like get through the year with them, but it has been a lot of fun. It's a really edifying subject. I always, whenever people tell me that I'm overthinking things, I'm like, I think, you know, video games are really complicated. Like, really.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot going on. So I keep finding new things. I've, I don't know. I hope I don't lose too many readers because I've been getting obsessed with virtual economies and like digital distribution. It's, you know, people in World of Warcraft do weird stuff.
I find that endlessly fascinating. So.
Yeah. Oh, it's so much money. It's like I'm reading some books right now by this guy who like made a couple million on Ultima Online, and you're just like, I mean, you sell like nothing for money.
Yeah.
I don't know. You can't even. Yeah, at least other people get snake oil, you know?
Well, somebody's got to write about this stuff because it's interesting and, you know, it requires a tremendous investment of time. I mean, I'm interested in those subjects, but then I think, well, God, you know, I'd have to drop everything else I'm doing and sort of immerse myself in that world. And it's just incredibly time consuming.
Oh, well, I mean, the great thing is people have written so much about it at this point that I have like a handful of friends who are 10 times more hardcore than me at playing video games. And I think Jesper Juul called it the game-centric view, where I just interview them a lot. Because, I mean, like the amount of time and energy that they can put into it. And I mean, you know, a lot of it's just like, I have to play a lot of games, you know, just to get through the year. And I just gotten to a point where I just interview experts now. And that kind of like, I'll play the game, like Modern Warfare 2 for my write-up, you know, I played the game and I got a pretty good grip on the multiplayer, and then I just bounced emails with people who had prestiged, I think, like twice now. And I was like, okay, can you spare a minute? And, you know, they had way more insight than I was ever going to get.
That seems like a useful approach.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I like not having to pretend to be the expert on everything.
Oh, and you admit it immediately. And, you know, I remember when I did the Halo 3 piece, I kind of had the same reaction as I was just kind of like, you know, I'm a casual player. I'm only on Social Slayer. And, yeah, I still get reamed, but I feel like people take it easy on you if you just, like, fess up that you're not trying to act like you're a pro.
Yeah. So, Kirk, what's your favorite game of 2009?
I'm going with, it's got a lot of recognition already, but Retro Game Challenge blew me away this year. I think for me, I always kind of have this sort of weird relationship between rules and plots that I always look for just because of my school background. You know, like, just to me, like, I'm very familiar with certain types of rules produce certain types of behavior in people. And, you know, my training, that's a lawsuit, but in, you know, in games, it's always just fascinating to me how you kind of can create such interesting stories by matching it to kind of a rule structure in the ways you can tweak people's behavior. But Retro Game Challenge just blew me away because it kind of took that whole approach and kind of blew it up, because it was kind of, there's so many layers of game going on at once. Like, the games themselves are all, they're very clever retro homages. I didn't recognize all of them. Like, Haggleman, I think, is a Japanese-only game, and I never got into racing games that much on the NES, but I remember when I played up the Galaga clone, just, I mean, it was perfect. And it wasn't just perfect in the sense that I'm shooting at aliens from my rocket ship. It kind of, it was like, it was more fluid. Like, they'd smoothed all the problems in a retro game of like the difficult barrier and things like that. And yet it didn't turn it into a modern game where everything is like hand fed to you. You know, you have to check the manual, you have to check the magazine for like clues and things like that. And also the challenges are constantly getting you to like push at the different layers of the game. I remember, the Guardia Quest game, which is the JRPG homage, it was really impressive to me because, I mean, it was, you immediately felt like you were playing, you know, Final Fantasy from 1986 or I forget the exact year. But what's amazing is, you know, I plowed through the game for about an hour and a half, and then, like, there was a section of the game where you had to grind. Except, like, the way they'd set it up, there were, like, two rooms where if you just stayed there for, like, 20 minutes, you would have enough experience, you know, to continue on. And it was like, they even, you know, each of these games only takes like 3 or 4 hours to beat, but it amazed me that they even, like, you know, you grinded, but it wasn't like in a normal game where it's just hours of your life and you don't know where it's going. This game, it was like, and now we're going to grind, and now we're done grinding. Wasn't that fun? That was, you know, good nostalgia. And it was such a, it just did all of it so well. The, like, the derby car game, or, I remember there's a Ninja Gaiden homage that, I mean, I was really impressed by, because, you know, rather than like dumb it down, they just kind of merged it with a few other things, so you could, you know, at the end of each level, you can like buy a health potion. I think I'm thinking of this the right way.
It was one of the Haggleman sequels, right? Like, they They made a few different games out of that.
Robot Ninja Haggle Man 3 or some crazy thing like that.
But what really impressed me, you know, and they were cool, and I think if the game was just about that, I probably wouldn't have been as impressed, but it's that whole meta layer of being a child playing them that just blew me away. Like, for example, like the manuals and the magazines. Typically in a game, like, I will never read an in-game text. Like, I just, you know, it's like Oblivion or something, I'm not really going to sit and read a book. I remember, you know, the first time I ever saw one was in Myst and just being, like, confounded by the idea that I was supposed to be playing the game and read, you know, a book. And, you know, it's tough enough to get anyone to pay attention to a cutscene, much less, you know, someone where, like, someone's, like, writing their fan fiction or something, and you just... So I never do it. But the game makes it so you have to, first of all, to progress very far, you have to read the different magazines to figure out the tips. Like, the challenge will be figure out how to do a speed boost. So you have to open up issue number 88 to do that. But they're so, I mean, just ridiculous that, like, you just read them all the way through. And I even found myself reading the previews. Because I was like excited about upcoming games within the game, and you know, the editors of the magazine were all just like these totally insane 20 somethings where it's just like, could this be the best video game ever made? Find out next issue.
And they're modeled after real, like, Dan Shu is clearly the model for one of them.
Right? Yeah, they're photographs of actual people in the American games industry. Like, they localized it. Like, I know that like the founder of Play Magazine is one of them. Like, somebody that I know in games journalism basically pointed out, this guy's this guy, this guy's this guy. They're all real people. It's funny.
Well, I love the one who goes and forms a J-pop band, and he just writes his editorial, and it's not even about games. It's just, I've always wanted to be a Japanese pop singer, and I can't believe the way that it all just merges together in that great way that so many games, I feel like, kind of struggle. You know, they'll always, it's just getting all the pieces to come together that's tough in so many titles. I mean, you know, talking about Modern Warfare 2, I highly doubt they wanted me to go examine the Burger World lineup during No Russian. I don't think, you know, like Shadow Complex, where the story is completely incoherent, but the game's really fun. And so, you know, I always, you know, when you're playing games, you kind of just see which part isn't connecting and then kind of chunk it out. Like I was just playing Assassin's Creed 2, and there was a point in the game where Ezio was like, I have done so much, and yet I don't know why. And I was like, I've been thinking that the whole game.
I remember that exact moment, because I was like, oh, thank God, they're finally going to, like, explain what the hell is going on, because I forgot about 6 hours ago.
In some games you chuck the plot, and others you tune them in, and it just depends. I mean, Uncharted 2, you know, I loved it when Drake was worried about whether or not they were going to be killing Garth, because it was like, Drake, come on, buddy. I know you're having fun.
Retro Game Challenge, the thing about it, too, for me, you sort of mentioned this, but the games that are obviously modeled on pre-existing games are almost in every case better than the original. Like, they clean them up a little, they play better, they look great, they're really sharp, they control well. It's almost like sacrilege the way the game sort of lovingly, in some ways, parodies these games, but also kind of one-ups them in a funny kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed to me like they stuck to the technical limitations of the time. Like, they didn't have more colors on screen than would have actually been possible on an 8-bit system, I don't think. But yeah, all of the stuff that made the games more playable was sort of advances in just usability that people have found. Because that's a lot of what the problem is that you run into when you play older games, is not that the actual core mechanics that are there are that rough, but it's just like all the stuff that we've figured out in the last 20 years about, like, making sure the player always knows what they can or are supposed to do, and making sure you don't lose an enormous amount of progress when you die, and like all those kinds of things are what they improved the old games with. And yeah, it's weird, but it's really nice to play like an extremely retro 8-bit game that you actually don't get enormously frustrated by that often. So it's cool.
That game got me in trouble, I should say. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, yeah, I just sort of bounced it around. But I think my favorite moment of the game was the delays, how like they would delay certain games. And there's this great moment where the kid sitting next to you is like, did you hear Guardia Quest got delayed again? And he's like, instead, he's like, I don't have anything else to do, so we can just put a sequel to Starfighter. And I remember, like, the disappointment. And it nailed it perfectly, because you're like, oh, I was really looking forward to that. Because it gets you used to that sequence, and you're like playing Starfighter, and you kind of start to like it after a while. And I was like, I'm a kid again. Like, this is exactly what it was like when you're sitting there.
You are the young version of the guy who turns out to be, you know, the sort of devilishly evil guy. So there's this odd little kind of framing twist that they put in it, too.
Yeah. How did the game get you in trouble, Michael?
Oh, well, I took the game with me on our spring break trip. My wife and I took to Santa Fe, and we had reached the desert because she was driving, and I was just really in the middle of Retro Game Challenge. And I sort of like didn't want to get out of the car for, you know, just a little while. I mean, I eventually got out of the car, but the game was just like that game, you know, I mean, there are certain people that totally relate to this. That game just totally had my name written all over it. Anybody who's of a certain age who played those games and really remember those games with affection, it's just like packages all of them up, puts this really cool self-aware kind of twisty frame on it, and oh, it's just like manna from heaven, that game.
Yeah, I mean I loved the framing in the end more than any of the actual games, you know, like I wanted to play more of it to hang out on the floor in front of the television with the other kid more, you know, not to like play the next sequel.
Yeah,
mostly. And because there's just so much heart to it, you know, it's clearly by people who had that experience that wanted to, you know, relive or share that experience with other people. You know, it's the whole like you said, it was made just for you. It's a beacon for people that's like, remember this? Remember when you were this kid? If you do, this is for you, kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And just like, yeah, the weird idea of simulating two kids playing Nintendo together and looking at video game magazines for cheat codes is such a wonderful thing for a game to include. It struck home with me too, and I loved that part of it.
I think it was a good year for DS games. We don't talk about them very much, but I think there were quite a few good DS games this year, actually.
Yeah, I liked Clash of Heroes. That's what I've been playing most recently on the DS. Wow. Another really good one. Surprised me.
Yeah, that one, I'm amazed by the number of ways you can take Bejeweled and turn it into other things. It's amazing to me to watch that happen. So before we go, this is great. Three really interesting games, and I think games that probably a lot of people maybe didn't get to play or haven't heard about much. So I'm really grateful for you sort of shining light on those kinds of games. I'm curious to know from you guys what you think next year has in store. I mean, are you looking forward to a game next year with more anticipation than maybe other games?
You better say BioShock 2. Just kidding.
It's BioShock 2. What about you, Chris? BioShock 2?
Tell us everything about it.
Well, it'll be released on February 9th, and you can return to the world of Rapture. The thing is, like, 2010 is really interesting because, as everyone's noted, it seems like half of 2009 got pushed to 2010. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to be looking forward to. I don't like when I just off the top of my head, Splinter Cell Conviction looks really cool. Seems like they've done a lot of interesting things with the general idea of Splinter Cell to change it up. I get more interested in that every time I watch like a preview video of it. That's one. What else? Last Guardian is not going to come out next year. If it was, that would be it. but I have to assume I can't imagine that'll actually hit until 2011. But maybe it would. I don't know. That would be cool.
What about you, Chris?
It's funny, and I've been looking at like lists of games coming out. I mean, BioShock 2 I'm definitely interested in, and not just because you're on the line, Steve. And, you know, Mass Effect 2, I had trouble with the last one, but I feel like of modern games, I probably know BioWare's titles better than anyone else's. I'm just sort of, I've followed them so long and followed their evolution in the way they do their stories and their characters and the way they wrestle with their fight systems. I can't help but be really curious about where that goes. And I think, you know, another kind of game I'm looking for in general is just, I've kind of followed the augmented reality, alternate reality, virtual social experience, social networking game space to some extent, with a little mobile thrown in there too. And I keep watching it for something that's really going to break, that's going to be like the World of Warcraft of that space, where all these weird arcane technologies that only really stubborn and obsessive people get involved in suddenly click into something that's as easy as miniature golf and everyone wants a part of it. You know, we had a lot of disappointments in the last decade. You know, I was interested in Second Life for a while and wrote some stories about it and never really actually enjoyed it. And there have been a lot, you know, I mean, it always seemed like a good idea at the time and then somehow just never wanted to spend time in it unless I had to. But there are all those kinds of things. And, you know, I've talked to some people this year who had some interesting ideas in that space. And you see things like, you know, Playdom, that they've got Steve Moretzky, that they've got David Carlton, and a lot of really neat people over there. And you talk to people who are interested in taking Facebook games, but making them more challenging and more interesting. I feel like there's some way to do that, and someone's going to make it work. And the way they'll do it is something where there's a very low barrier of entry, a low level of commitment to stay involved from day to day. You're not going to have to read some arcane lore. And it won't just be something like, you know, Drop 7 is a fantastic, fun, addictive game that leads you into an alternate reality game. But to take that extra step into the hardcore portion is really like signing your life away. You have to, you know, there's just a big disconnect between the, or a big gap between the two. I feel like someone's going to make something that's going to click, that you're going to be hitting every day from your mobile device, that's going to give you another sort of level of engagement, and not just like Farmville, and sort of, you can feel like you're being someone other than yourself, but it won't depend on being that obsessive about it. And I'd love to see someone crack that problem.
That's one of the things that's most interesting to me about like iPhone stuff, is that it can actually superimpose things over what the camera is seeing. It seems like there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, you know, that might help, you know, alternate reality games start out that the world is your platform and that anything in the world could work with that. And I think that genre is fascinating and is also kind of broken and kind of inaccessible to almost anybody. I was driving around, I was like, you know what would be fun would be to have a game where you grind by taking photos of stop signs. And maybe that's the game, is that today you just have to drive around and take photos of stop signs. But that would be kind of fun. You know, it's something that's easy, something that anyone could do. But then it's like, oh, I want to get more of them. Maybe I'll take a couple extra turns to get a few more stop signs and level up. And then the next day it's like, you have to take a photo of something at McDonald's. Or I don't even know. But like that kind of ease of entry, but then it kind of makes you feel like you're part of something other. Some yeah. sort of fantasy. I don't know. I agree with you, though. Yeah, the fact that the iPhone can bring so many things together and with such a rich interface and such a portable package, I think there's a lot of potential there.
I can't help but think about the educational possibilities of that sort of a game. You sort of turn kids loose on these little expeditions where they have to do certain things and investigate certain things, and you know that device in their hand could enable all kinds of really interesting opportunities if it was well designed.
Yeah, yeah. And if it was fun, if it wasn't just like, there are 10 insects.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to find all of them. You know, it's.
Sometimes I kind of wonder, like, if something like Facebook isn't already sort of there. I mean, I've just been playing a lot of Farmville, and what's sort of interesting about that game to me is how much it's already. I get to a point where it's like, well, what else would I want it to do? Because you're sort of like, well, if it's information like photographs, you know, like connecting people more. You know, Farmville tapers out because it just turns into a pyramid scheme after a while. And but, I mean, you know, it's still a good one. It's a well-made one. I don't want to rag on it. There's 60 million fans. but I started playing it, and, I mean, it is... they basically take the whole, like... It's like 5-minute SimCity burst. I don't know. It's one of those games I haven't quite wrapped my head around because there's my experience with it, which has been... This is kind of lame, and I don't really know what I'm doing. And, you know, then like 3 weeks later, I'm still playing. But then I talked to a fan of it, and they're, like, my cousin at Christmas was like, why aren't you sending more gifts, damn it? I have to, you know, that thing's not making itself. And like, gold turkey, and I was like, wow. So I come back to that. I don't know. I've also been reading Jesper Juul's Casual Revolutions book. And the thing he keeps talking about is that the ones who are looking for the sort of second life type experience are kind of in the minority. Like, once you just lower your standards of what you expected the virtual world to be, it's already sort of there in some level, like the basic framework.
Well, that's, yeah, and I mean, yeah, which is the problem. Second Life was too heavy, and like, there are people who do really serious role-playing on there, but it's like the amount of time it takes. But at the same time, I haven't played Farmville. I've played some of those other kind of games, and even back to Skyraids, which I got really addicted to for a couple weeks, just by the persistence of it and the repetition of it. But it seems like a lot of these games don't have any element of role-playing. And I want to say role-playing because that usually connotes spending hours developing something and speaking in tongues and doing all these things. But, you know, I was thinking about some of the past things like Star Wars. You know, so our generation, most of us were touched by Star Wars and got involved with Star Wars and grew up with it. And it was like the biggest thing in the world. You know, I was 4 when the first one came out. So that defined me. And playing with the toys and all the things like that, like it gave you a chance to kind of be something other than who you are. And then, you know, I was even thinking, like, what's the largest transmedia experience before that? It was probably World War II. Now, of course, that was real and people died. And I don't want to put it lightly by putting the same thing as me playing with Star Wars toys. But it was almost transformational in the same way because it was huge and it impacted lots of people. And there was a main narrative, but it just barely touched your experience of it. And it was, again, something where you went and you were someone other than who you are. And something with repercussions beyond that. I mean, you know, again, people talk about transmedia, and I'm fascinated by that too, but there is no transmedia bigger than World War II. We still see it all the time. People are still writing books like The English Patient or whatever. I mean, it's still the biggest, and then Star Wars is probably the second biggest. And it just got me thinking, like, what would be the next thing? Like, what would be something that has its own mythology, has some canon, something that people can rally around, but then your experience of it is so personal and so much about you, and yet isn't you. It isn't me in my daily life, and then I go and I'm doing a farm. It's sort of something you can kind of believe in a little that does touch your imagination a little. Mm. And that is sort of what I'm trying to, I don't know. I guess that's what I'm looking for. So if someone figures that out and makes billions of dollars off it, then I'll play it.
I mean, World of Warcraft is practically that, isn't it? I mean, millions and millions of people all over the world go to, Azeroth, and, you know, it's this parallel reality that everyone shares and that so many people are invested in. I mean, it feels like it has a, like broad appeal but strong identity the way that something like Star Wars does. And, I mean, it's definitely kind of connects to more people that play games than any other game aside from something that is so casual it's almost not a game in the same sense, like Farmville. I don't know.
Right. Well, you know, personally, I mean, World of Warcraft, and I played it for, I gave it about 100 hours, and I only got to level 40, so I haven't seen the end game and so forth. But it just seems like it's, the rules are so clear. I always just think of it more as something like a bowling league or a miniature golf game, where it just, I know there are people who role play really seriously, and it's such an amazing accomplishment in so many ways, but it feels like it's sort of a closed system. It's so bound to the rules. The pleasure in it is in understanding those rules and then working through them, working through the activities you're handed. And I never felt it gave you much space, and people have disagreed with me, but I never felt it gave you much space to kind of do your own thing with it.
Yeah,
that the real pleasure lay in the fact that you could go fishing and maybe you'd get that lobster that had a 1 in 1,000 drop rate, and that you would keep fishing and fishing and fishing, and then you got the lobster and you just were on top of the world, you know. But that wasn't the same as like if you could just make your own lobster. You know, I don't know. I'm not an MMOG designer, but it just feels like you know, you're doing it for what it's giving you rather than kind of carving out so much of your own space in it.
Mm.
And also my experience of it, that the players mostly don't really use their imagination in it at all. That it's, they'll run around talking about the Colts game while they're grinding through this fantastic purple-treed region of amazing-looking things.
Right. But I mean, I don't know. I guess I see the other comparisons that you brought up as being similarly a static shared context, you know? I mean, like, everyone shares what the events of World War II or the fiction and presence of Star Wars are as a thing that they don't actually touch, but that they all share in common. And that kind of feels what, at least like what the place you go when you play World of Warcraft is, even if, you know, the stuff you do is fairly deterministic. aside from the social aspect of it. I don't know. Just thinking out loud.
Yeah.
But
no, that's a really good point. I think you're definitely onto it with that. Yeah, because it does give such a powerful shared experience to so many people.
It seems like it's a less extensible experience though than say something like Star Wars, where you know in terms of its kind of cultural penetration, it's really something that's got a very high geek level, you know, associated with it. That you to get in there, you have to really make a certain series of commitments that are, the bar is high. So, you know, and unlike Star Wars, you can just run to Kmart and get an action figure. That you can have all kinds of ways of accessing that mythos and that sort of ongoing universe that World of Warcraft doesn't afford.
I don't know, maybe. I mean, you know, World of Warcraft's been on South Park and they have like collectible card game extension of the universe, and they have like all of the BlizzCon stuff between posters and t-shirts and
Mr. Fucking, T, they got Mr. T.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they have like action figures and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. I don't want to argue too strongly in favor of it, but it does feel like the closest that video games have to a central cultural touchstone that kind of speaks to people from all different nations and that they actually share it together, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. On that scale, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, yeah, exactly. That's not to be discounted. Like I'm with Michael that I think there's something else, and it's sort of the idea of unstructured play, which is a hard thing to get into because that's something that makes sense for 4-year-olds like my kid, but not so much for adults because we don't believe in it. And we don't really have that in our lives anymore. And, you know, I'm cautious to figure out how to bring that into an adult space. But it's, I don't know. But I mean, you're totally right that they've created this environment that's, you know, again, every year we see more MMOGs come in and try and beat it. And they just can't because it's like beating America. You know, you can't come in and say, oh, well, I've got a new America. Like, well, sorry, we've got the one we want. It's already got cheeseburgers. You don't have cheeseburgers.
That's an intense analogy.
Kirk, yeah, what about you? You got a game you got your eye on?
I'm trying to think how to follow that one up. You know, honestly, I mostly play old games. Like, I kind of... If you want to talk about niches, that's kind of the one I sort of dig around in just because it's easier on my wallet. And, you know, I kind of enjoy, and speaking of like shared experiences, I enjoy talking about a game that people have already played way more than the, hey, come play this game conversation, just because you can get to this deeper level, you know? So, but in terms of new games for 2010, I'm a huge Western sucker. I loved Gun, despite all its flaws. I even like the other Western game. I played that god-awful LucasArts one. So, Red Dead. Yeah, is that what it was called? One of like it had cartoon segments and then these like Doom sections.
Yeah, from like 1996. Yeah.
Yes, the 2.5D era, and so I'm really excited for Red Dead Redemption. I love games like that. Just the vibe and. You know, the way the graphics are now, they can't really do a good deciduous forest, but man, they can make a gorgeous desert, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to that too. I mean, it looks really great, and I've been really happy with almost everything that Rockstar has done outside of the GTA series, like The Warriors and Bully are some of my favorite games. Yeah. So yeah, I think putting an open world action adventure experience in that frame that fictional frame that we hardly ever see people take advantage of, I think it's going to be really great.
I think there's an audience for it too. The last two times that I've taught my sort of history of video games course, we end the course by having the students design their own game, you know, all on paper and sort of what would the world look like and what sort of game would it be and how would the player engage. And both times they've made Westerns.
Wow.
Yeah, which just, I mean, partly because I think they see it as kind of an untapped potential, you know, really great game world and a great set of icons. And, you know, there's a whole mythos around it that you don't have to build from scratch. And they just don't see that game on the shelf. And they think that's like a brand new idea. So,
yeah.
Interesting.
It's something that I've thought of before, just as far as like what are theoretically the kinds of... environments or, you know, like what kind of fiction could support like RPG mechanics the way we think of them. And, you know, it kind of requires a certain amount of open space and lawlessness and, you know, some amount of, you know, danger and combat and, wildlife and all, you know, like, and so we have basically at this point fantasy, you know, like medieval fantasy and post-apocalyptic, you know, Fallout style games that support those things. But it seems like the Old West is a pretty fertile ground for being an RPG place that, you know, that you can have those kinds of interactions that hasn't really been taken advantage of yet, at least not in video games.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for your time and for this conversation. And I hope that you guys have a great 2010.
And, likewise.
I hope we can get together again soon. And also, I'll put all of your blogs and writing and projects and stuff on my on my blog when I post this podcast. But I want to encourage everybody to check out all of your work. You know, the whole thing about me inviting you on is because I love what you guys do. And I really appreciate you taking time out and spending it with me chatting about games.
Well, it's been great. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Anytime. Thanks.
All right, gentlemen. Take care. And we'll see you soon.
Take care.
Thanks again. Bye.